TV, comics, movie stars,
hit singles and some toys.
It's trivia and dirty jokes,
an evening with the boys.
Once is never good enough for
something so fantastic.
So here's another Gilbert and Franks.
Here's another Gilbert and Franks. Here's another Gilbert and Franks.
Colossal classic.
Hey, I'm Clint Howard, and you're listening to Gilbert Gottfried's amazing Colossal Podcast. Right here, right now. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast. I'm here once again with my co-host, Frank Santopadre, and we're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer, Frank Verderosa. Our guest this week is someone who Frank and I have admired for many years, and we're thrilled for the opportunity to have him on the podcast. He's one of the busiest, and we mean busiest, and most respected and versatile actors of the last half century, with over 219 film and TV credits. Memorable television appearances include Bonanza, All in the Family, Ironside, The Waltons, The Bob Newhart Show, Amazing Stories, Unsung, co-starring former podcast guest Richard Kind, The X-Files, Ken Burns, The Civil War, Frasier, and Damages, just to name a few. He's also made his mark with unforgettable performances in dozens of movies such as Little Big Man, Serpico, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, What's Up, Doc?, Slapshot, Ordinary People, Reds, Straight Time, Blade Runner, The Jerk, Fletch, Back to School, Clean and Sober, and of course, as the double-crossing private eye, Lauren Visser, in the Coen brothers' Blood Simple, for which he was awarded the Independent Spirit Award for Best Actor. Over the course of a six-decade career, he shared the screen with and often stolen scenes from heavyweights such as Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman, Harrison Ford, Gene Hackman, and Paul Newman. And if you don't believe us, just watch the films for yourself. His dependable and consistently impressive body of work led film critic Roger Ebert to coin the phrase the Stanton Walsh Rule, meaning any movie featuring either Harry Dean Stanton or M. Emmett Walsh couldn't be old bad. Please welcome to the show an actor's actor, and a man who says he never understood what the hell the original Blade Runner was all about. The legendary M. Emmett Walsh.
I guess I'm supposed to say thank you. I mean, it's an hour-long show, and you just took off 55 minutes. I
mean, what's it? That's it. The intros are a little lengthy, haven't
they? Yeah, they serve as an intro and an obituary.
Holy gee. It made it sound like my career is over. Thank you.
Well, it's a retrospective. You've done a lot.
Is profanity allowed on the
Absolutely.
Show?
We insist on it.
Now,
who else calls you two assholes?
Lots of people.
Okay, good. Fine. I want to be in the marching crowd.
Now, can we hit on that Stanton Walsh rule again? You said you've broken that rule.
No, well, Roger Ebert, Siskel and Ebert. Yeah, there was a review later on something I did, and he said I broke the rule. it wasn't watchable.
Wild Wild West.
Was that the one? Wild Wild West?
I don't know. It could have been. Yeah. Could have been. I have no idea. But I met them both at different. Or I talked to the guy in Chicago, the last one to die. You know, I talked to him in Chicago one time on a radio type of thing, way way back.
Ebert.
But Siskel and Ebert. Well, they were very nice to me, and a lot of people, you know, do remember that Siskel Ebert, quote. So it's nice. What the hell?
Yeah, I think you said Stanton broke the rule. With Dream a Little Dream.
Well, I don't know that. I don't know. Well, Harry Dean just died within the last year, didn't
just
he?
Just died, yeah. Big talent. Yeah. Well, it's true. Yeah. It's true. The two of you in a movie is a sign that you're in for a decent experience.
Well, the thing is, Harry Dean, I did something with him. What in the hell was that one? We did a film together, huh? Was it Straight Time?
Oh, he's in Straight Time, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
With Harry Dean. Yeah, Harry Dean was Harry Dean. You know, I basically don't want you to know Emmett Walsh. I want you to know a cop or a minister or a killer or the president of Princeton. And then when I say that, I get 374 letters from Princeton saying, get our college off your fucking lips, will you?
You prefer to disappear into the role than somebody say there's Emmett Walsh.
I'm not saying that they had come to me at some early stage and offered me tons of money to play the same character for 30 years, I wouldn't have done it. But I have fun not being Michael Emmett Walsh. And when I joined my first union, I couldn't. There was a Michael Walsh. Like there could not be two. There could not be two Spencer Tracys at one time. They protect a person's name, the unions. So rather than becoming, rather than becoming Gilbert or Frank, you know, I decided to go with my first initial and my middle name. That was supposed to be a laugh. These guys are dull.
We're being roasted by Emmett Walsh 5 minutes into the show. Yeah, I think Michael Keaton took the name Keaton because he was Michael Douglas.
No. Michael Keaton. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was well known that the. So when I got my first union card, which I think was Equity, the stage union in New York, you know, and I knew I couldn't use the name. Rather, you know, I there had been a wonderful character actor back in the 30s and 40s. J. Carroll Nash.
Oh, yes. Sure, we know.
Yes. I always liked the sound of it, you know, J. Carroll Nash. But, and then I went with the M, you know, rather than going with, you know, the one of the clowns' names here or something. But no one can say M. Emmett Walsh. It scans all right. You can read it. Like Harry Dean Stanton, you know, J. Carroll Nash has a poetic mm-hmm. sound to it. But you can't say M. Emmett Walsh with it guts itself up. It looks okay on paper, but you can't say it out loud. So, but that's where it came from. My mother's favorite brother was Emmett Sullivan, so that's where the middle name came from.
So you took that,
and it's spelled E M M E T the Irish way. You know, Robert Emmett, a Nathan Hale of Ireland, who was hung by the English back in 1820 something. It was a surname. He was a Protestant. But Robert Emmett spelled it as one T. And the Irish, who were uneducated and so forth, to pay homage to this great person, spelled his name wrong for the next 200 years.
Oh, man. Well, tell us what you were, before we turn the mics on, Emmett, you were telling us the story of how you're from Vermont. You came to New York against your mother's wishes.
Are you telling me the mics aren't on now?
They are now.
Yeah.
They were until Gilbert read his intro.
Yeah.
But you were fascinating us. You were telling us how your mother did not want you to come to New York, and you took a chance.
Oh, no, I have a degree in marketing. I have a degree in business. And my mother, you know, lovely Irish lady. My Laurence Olivier said his mother had the wish. The way he got into theater, into acting, was his mother had the wish and never did anything with it. My father had the wish, if I picked it up from someone in the family. But my father never did it. You know, he was a machine gun in the First World War and all this other stuff. But I got the wish from my father. And then when I was finishing up in college, you know, the dean of students had me in, you know, Clarkson University. Now it's Clarkson College up in Potsdam, New York. St. Lawrence is right next to Clarkson up there in the north. My college is only 150 miles from where I grew up in Vermont. And the dean of students had me when I was finally graduating, and I wasn't doing it in 4 years. It was just taking a little bit longer than that. And he said, okay, Walsh, he said, you're going to graduate. We can't stop it. But we want you to know you're graduating with the lowest marks of anyone in 7 years.
Wow.
So that's the way Clarkson College put me out. You know, and of course, they had me back for the 50th reunion, gave me the Golden Knight Award. You know,
right now that you made it, they'll take you back.
You think I did not rub their asses in it, you bastard?
Now, you received one of, like, the worst insults, I guess, that any man can receive. When you did Straight Time with Dustin Hoffman, in one part, Dustin Hoffman handcuffs you to a street pole.
I know where you're going here.
And he pulls your pants down. So you're there with your naked ass out. And you said at one point you turned around and you could see your dick. And that caused like an argument over whether it would be an R or X rating.
Yeah, and?
Well, then, so no one wants an X rating because, you know, you'll lose.
You've done a terrible job of setting up this line.
Yeah. Okay, so you tell it.
Jesus,
I'm telling you so you can do it.
I feel like my career is over and I came here just to do what? Anyway, at that time, any frontal nudity in a film was an automatic X rated. Any frontal nudity. And Dustin overpowers me in the car. I'm his parole officer, taking him away to someplace. And he ends up handcuffing me to a freeway divider where my hands are up above my head. And then he pulls down my trousers. I am exposed on the freeway, and cars are going by with their honking their horns and so forth. And I'm tied there with my, you know, with my trousers down. At one point in there, I kind of swung towards where the camera was, which was across the freeway, and I exposed what had before just been my bare ass, you know, so you saw it from the other side. At that time, any frontal nudity in a movie was an automatic X rating, and I was told that the committee that gives the rating to the films looked at it, saw the scene, saw me turn towards the camera, and said, that's not worth an X. The hell with it. Give him an R.
He does tell it better.
So your dick is not worth an X ray.
Well, I've got three dead wives that died under mysterious circumstances that didn't complain that much, but I got sick of them.
I liked another line you said, Emmett, about tell us what people would see if you were in a movie playing Jamie Lee Curtis's lover. I thought that was very, very funny and very telling.
That's right. Jamie Lee. Yeah, I said if the movie opens up and I am Jamie Lee Curtis's husband or lover or boyfriend or something, you know I'm dead in 10 minutes. And then she spends the next hour and a half looking for the killer.
I mean, I love that.
I don't stay there very long. You know, Jamie Lee, she's a sweetheart.
She is. So you came to New York to do serious theater. You had an interest in doing Molière and Shaw and those kind of things. You didn't say I'm gonna be a character actor.
Well, intellectually, I could understand Shaw and Shakespeare and Molière. Mm-hmm. But I'd been deaf in my left ear since the time I was 3 years old. I had a mastoid operation when I was three. Now they 90% of the time they can clear that up with penicillin. But in 1938, there was no penicillin, really. And so they did an operation that more or less deafened me in my left ear. And I grew up in northern Vermont. And I, you know, I did come down to New York, and I wanted intellectually to do Shaw and Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. But I said things like, Pfeffer. And they said, what? Pfeffer. And they said, what are you saying? What did you want to go and do that for? Pfeffer. And they said, you want to do Shaw and Shakespeare? I said, well, they understand me at home. So that's where I started. It was obvious I wasn't going to do Shaw and Shakespeare and Molière. My speech was just simply too bad. You mm-hmm. couldn't go back and, you know, kids 14 were doing Shakespeare, and I couldn't speak English. So I had to figure out if I was going to do it, you know, what I could do that no one else could do. And that's the hard point. People go and try to become the next Pacino or the next Meryl Streep or something. They don't want that. They want something new, something different. They want you. And actors have a hard time figuring that out. So I had to figure out who I was and why what I could do no one else could do. And that's where I started, fooling around and all that. I'm an old jock. I led it in four sports. I'm a par golfer, you know, and, athletically I could do anything. I just had fun. People brought me in. Once they got onto me and figured me out, they'd say, well, this is terrible crap, but get Walsh, at least he makes it believable.
So I love that.
And I got a lot of those jobs. I've done 118 feature films.
It's amazing.
There's a lot of stuff out there. And I'm not ashamed of they're not all Hamlet, but I'm not ashamed of any of it. Some is quite interesting.
Yeah, some that we read.
And you have played, I think, what's been described as the nice villains. And it makes you even more scary that you're one of those villains with, like, the smile on the face and, you know, a good old boy attitude.
Yeah, well, I don't know about the ninth villain, but
I think he said nice villain.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Nice. Well, that you try to add humanity to these characters.
I finally meet someone with speech worse than mine. Thank you. I'm a nice villain.
This is like interviewing Bob Einstein. we're being ripped apart.
I don't know. Where are we?
Well, you were talking about how you try to humanize bad guys.
No. Like Blood Simple was a film I did that for the Coen Brothers, the Coen Brothers' first movie, mm-hmm. Blood Simple, where I played the private detective that the
Visser.
Gumball type of guy. And if you're playing, I learned early on, if you're playing a villain, the villain goes home and he flirts with his wife. He takes the kids out to the park. You know, he's the nicest guy in the world. He has a bad job on the weekends, you know, but he's not a villain. If you play a villain as a villain, it's not very interesting. Early on in the theater, you learn if the character cries, the audience doesn't. So the most interesting thing about acting a bit is to avoid the tears and let the audience cry. And most actors want to cry, you know, type of thing. And that kind of kills it a little bit. It's I don't know if that means anything to you guys.
That's interesting.
I'm looking at you, and I said, did either one of them get out of high school? Look at that.
You flatter us. We're much older than that, Emmett. So you went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts?
For 2 years after I went down in New York.
Right.
And I didn't know anything. I said I couldn't, you know, and somehow I had the wish. Olivier said he got the wish from his mother. I got the wish from my father.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done theater in high school and college and so forth. You know, I enjoyed it out on stage. Being on stage was fun for me. I was never afraid of it. And, so I went to New York, but I didn't know anything. I auditioned at a school called the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and they take you know, more or less anybody for the first year. Then they they weed it out mm-hmm. and invited back for the second year. I came very close and I didn't be invited back for the second year. Now they both the schools on the West Coast and the East Coast have a third year connected to it, and but that's where I would in New York when I started, you could see any play you wanted to. You put on a jacket and a tie, and you kind of hang around outside the theater at the first intermission, you know, and they come out to have a cigarette or something, and you kind of walk in with them, and there's always an empty seat or something, and you sit, and I watched the last two acts of Miracle Worker or Raisin in the Sun,
wow.
you know, 10, 15, 20 times. But I'm watching actors do this stuff, you know, and eventually the people in the theater, the door people, and they get used to it. Come on in, sit down, you know, the whole thing. But I was an empty disc picking up an impression. You know, I didn't have to unlearn something. If you're a football player and you go to Notre Dame, they spend the first 2 years unlearning what you learned in high school so you could be a decent college football player. I didn't have to unlearn anything. You know, I was spooking it all up. And then in time, I would go to a play, and I was amazed by it all because I was a theater actor. I wasn't mm-hmm. a movie actor, mm-hmm. a television actor. And I'd watch and watch one. And then finally, I started seeing performances. And acting is beat to beat to beat with the character. And I'd see an actor do something on a given beat. And I said, no, that's not the way you should do that beat. And then I'd see another performance. You know, I'd start to pick on things where before I'd been totally awed by it all. And then it became obvious that if I'm sitting in the chair in the audience, why am I not up on that stage? You know, I said, well, how do I get my ass from here up to there if I'm so bloody smart? You know, and that became marketing. That, you know, I had to learn how to, if I got a chance to go meet people on something, to walk in, there'd be seven Emmett Walshes before me and six coming in after me. How could I win that job?
Well, that's fascinating.
With all these, you know, and so I had to learn how to go in there, but that was the marketing background. You know, I talked to the kids about this. I'd walk in there and basically they give you a page or a scene and you're reading with somebody and there's seven or eight people watching and you feel it. You know what's going on, you know. And if you there's an instinct type of thing. And if you thought it was not going well, you'd say, I'd worked this all out before. I'd say, hey, you know, what if this guy was a as opposed to he's written, what if he had a really bad stammer and he had trouble around people? What about that? And they said, well, show us what you mean. I'd take another one. I'd say, what if this guy was, as opposed to, what if he's very hostile? You know, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Yeah, sure, yeah. What else you want me to do? Anything else? Yeah, sure, I'll do that. And I said, well, we hadn't thought about that. You know, and I learned how to interview, how to audition, you know, and also there was only me. I mean, women found me totally repulsive, you know, so, you know, it was only me in the bar, you know, type of thing. So these people, you know, I might not get the job at, you know, on that end, but they remember me next time they came in.
Absolutely.
And I learned, you know, how to handle, that's marketing. I learned how to sell the product.
That's
great. I was the product.
How to separate yourself from the other Emmett Walshes.
And they're, you know, you can sit there at a casting call and watch people come in, and you could see people that they're thinking about the car payments or the kid's got needs more books for college or something. You know, they're not there. You know, you can see that. You know, it's you read these stories about somebody got the job at a cold interview, and it's just that. They learn how to handle it. You know, I learned how to kind of handle it. And I had a good time, and there wasn't – it was me. I could always work.
Got the ball rolling for you, Emmett? You were in a couple of plays. Was The Death of the Well-Loved Boy, was that sort of the first legitimate role?
I was going with a girl who worked for an advertising agency, McCann Erickson.
Mm-hmm. They're
and,
still around.
She got, I don't know if they are or not.
Yeah, they are.
And she got me a job doing an Esso commercial.
Esso gas. You know,
Esso Gasoline. You know, now it's Chevron. I don't know what the hell it is now, but it was Esso. And just on camera talking for, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 seconds, you know, doing an Esso commercial. And the casting person on that gave a call to an agent, you know, Don Buchwald, who's head of the Buchwald agency.
He's still around, too.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, he's big time.
Yeah, you know? Howard Stern's and, agent.
Yeah, Howard Stern's man.
Right.
And she got a hold of Buchwald, who was just getting into the agenting business, and he got a hold of me. And, you know, and as I say, I'm a loose cannon. And I'd go for an interview, and then he'd call and said, what did Walsh do? And they say, hey, look at you, what you can't do, you know, and he homed my interviewing process.
Wow.
You know, Don was involved. And I started to make money doing commercials. So then they'd call and say, we got a chance. There's a play they're doing off Broadway. You'd carry a spear. And I said, fuck you and your spears. I ain't carrying spears anymore. And they only knew me as a spear carrier, you know.
Right.
So they can't take an insult. They said, well, give him this, he'll fall on his face. By then, they were hiring a cannon to kill a cockroach. I was so ready that
there's no way.
And that's the way I started. And I started doing, you know, I did the commercials. Then I started doing the movies because the same casting people were doing commercials on television. And the word got out. He looks good on camera. He's interesting, you know, the whole thing. The 80% of acting, or maybe 75% of acting, can be taught. The other 20% is the gift, you know. I had nothing to do with it. That was a gift. I did the study. I learned everything you could, and then the gift got me to the next stage.
That's interesting. The things at an audition, the way he handles an audition, because Gilbert's done some acting roles in his career, and he absolutely hates auditioning.
Well, I'm looking at him, I can understand.
But I'm saying Emmett turned it to his advantage.
Yeah,
to separate himself from the people in the waiting room, he found a way.
Well, the thing this was my degree in college,
marketing,
administration, marketing.
Right, came in handy.
You know, how do you sell the product? You know, how do you sell the product? My father saw my success. You know, he came to New York. I was doing a Broadway play and so forth, and. My mother got Parkinson's, and she was in a nursing home for the last 10 years of her life, just, you know, shrinking to nothing. My mother never saw any of it. And, it was what I wanted to do. It's what I figured out how to do. And, I knew how to deal with money. You know, if you live at this line, you know, if your things are going well, you still live at this line.
Mm-hmm.
And if things are going poorly, the money that you saved above the line goes down here. You know, but most actors end up, you know, they chase the money. You know, they're doing well, then they do very well, then they buy the two Cadillacs and the Mercedes and the house and the whole thing. And then when things don't go well, then they're in trouble. I always, because of the business background, you know, learned how to handle the money I had and put it away. And normally, at this stage of my life, I have enough money not to do interviews like this.
Hilarious.
That was a perfect
payoff to that story, Emmett. Don't go away. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
I'm going away.
Stop it, you.
Frank went out to pee. Now they're back so they can be on their amazing colossal podcast.
Kids, time to get back to Gilbert and Frank's amazing colossal podcast. So let's go.
So the marketing and the business background really paid off.
Yeah, in my case.
Yeah, good for you. It paid off
as far as being able to live financially and also to get parts.
To sell himself, to know how to market as the product.
And you said I think you have a quote, I get paid to do nothing.
No, the quote is, I get paid to do what I do for nothing.
And that means?
You understand the difference? Yeah.
Yeah.
He loves it that much. All actors will do anything. They love acting, you know? And You know, I get paid a lot of money. Well, you know, now I'm either, what am I, 97 or 103? I'm some. I've had a good time. I've met interesting people, had a lot of fun with them. No one screws with me. If I walk on set or if I walk in front of the camera and you're doing a scene with me, you better damn well be good or I'll kill you. But if you're good and you see me coming in, you are going to make sure you don't lose to me. So you end up with a tennis match.
I love that.
You say something, the ball comes back. I say something, and it goes back and back and back. And the audience is going whack, 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 whack. And that's what makes the great theater. That's what makes great acting. You really watch the tennis match going on. And no one screws around with me because they know I'm there to help the material.
Of course.
I'm not there to make an Emmett Walsh, you know, type of thing.
Get Walsh, move the story along, I've heard you say.
They're not, you know, as they say, they're not writing movies for me. They're writing movies, you know, watch me fall off a curve.
Could we ask you about some of the early, and did you room with William Devane at one point, Emmett?
Yeah, Devane came down from Albany.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we all started at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York, which, as I said, was a two-year school. And anybody got it. And Bill Devane came down with another friend of his by the name of James Sloan, who was the voice of Lexus for years and years and years mm-hmm. recently. But they came down together, and we ended up five in a little downstairs underneath the street apartment up along 75th Street and Amsterdam Avenue or something, you know. And, Devane and I, and we were all together. And
good actor.
Devane got a leg up earlier. You know, we went to school for 2 years and so forth. Devane was kind of a male lead, you know, type of thing. I was a character person.
Mm-hmm.
I had to grow in, you know, into my stuff. And Devane studied and worked hard in the whole thing. And he's had a very good job.
Very nice career.
Yeah, no, and, you know, like everybody knows, he did John Kennedy back there.
That's
and
right.
It's still a hell of a good work. But he's done some very good films. He's always working, and he's believable.
Yeah.
No matter what it's in. You know, that's what we learned.
Did you work with Nichols and May back in those days, too?
I did a play, and that's curious. Thank you. I did a play that Elaine May wrote
mm-hmm.
and Mike Nichols directed up in Stockbridge, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been called A Matter of Position, but I'm not sure what it was. But all good character people from New York, and we're up in Stockbridge, Mass. And that's where I met Elaine and Michael.
Right.
And I've dealt with Elaine afterwards. Mike.
You were in Mikey and Nikki.
Mike, yeah, and the other guy, the male, whoever we're talking about.
Mike Nichols.
Mike Nichols. Mike Nichols had me in a movie or two, too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And, the thing is, what happens with a casting situation or a director or something, they say, look at this, there's 130,000 members of the Screen Actors Guild. 130,000 members. They'll say, look at, I only want to see 10 people. Now, how do you get ahead of all those people to get to be one of the 10 that gets in to see somebody, you know? And that's, you know, what
it's daunting.
Hell? Yeah. And so I was, you know, I auditioned well, and I met Mike well, and they would simply say, okay, we got Walsh for this. That takes care of that problem. Now let's see who we can get for the girl. You know, I was a problem solver. You know, they mm-hmm. they didn't have to worry about spending 2 days casting this. Did that make any sense to
yeah.
you?
Yeah. But I'm interested in those early days because you were in Midnight Cowboy with John Schlesinger, Alice's Restaurant with Arthur Penn. I mean, looking back.
Arthur Penn directed. Arthur Penn did a play up in Stockbridge, and that's where he met me.
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe it might have been the Elaine May play. And then after that, when Arthur, you know, Arthur gave me, Arthur brought me up for... What was that movie?
Alice's Restaurant.
Alice's Restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, I played the Sergeant in Group W, I think,
yeah.
Or something. Yeah, or something. But Arthur Penn, there was a thank you for what I'd done in the play, you know, type of thing. But it goes back to what I said. If you're casting something and you've got 12 problems, if they got me, they only had 11 problems. You know, and that was, I was, you know, I would take care of whatever it was they needed. And they didn't have to, they could go on with something. I don't want you, I said before, to see a Michael Emmett Walsh. I want you to see the garbage collector.
Right.
You know, and they knew that I wasn't going to do anything other than the garbage collector for them.
And
you know, and it solved the problem.
We always, like on this show, both of us, always admired the character actors because.
Yeah, we've had some good ones here. Bruce Dern and Steve Buscemi's been here.
And it's like, because when you see a movie, you'll go, wow, you know, Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep were great. And you forget the great character actors, you know, because you'll go, oh, that was a doctor in that scene or a cop. And you believe it's a doctor or a cop. You're not going, oh, that's a great performance.
Well, that's what character acting is about. Yeah. That's what you know, we're talking about, I'm a stage actor. I started out in the stage. I never thought in terms of movies and television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just thought if I could ever make a living as an actor on stage, that would be wonderful. And I did get to that, you know, but I never saw that what happened when I was on film. You know, I never had anything to do with that. That's a gift. I mean, the acting, I said before, is 75%. The gift is what, you know, Vanessa Redgrave had the, you know, she walked on film and you said, wow, you couldn't watch anything else.
Mm-hmm.
There are other actors like that, you know, that you say, wow, they just burn it. You know, they just burn the film. And I was given, you know, I was given the gift of, you know, I can walk on stage and people would watch me. I could walk on film and people watch me. Those are the gifts. You don't always get it in both cases. But, you know, that's luck. That's luck. And also, you know, I might have just stayed home and ran a bar, you know, type of thing.
Yeah. I'm glad you didn't.
And you had, I remember I'd heard this quote once before, and I forget the exact quote. Olivier said something about the angels.
Okay, before you ruin that quote. Olivier said, there are nights in the theater when the gods seem to come and sit on your shoulders.
That's great.
But on the nights when the gods don't come, the audience does.
Oh, that's profound. So they're there either way. Whether you have it or not, they're there.
The guy next to you understand that at all? He's just at the real
yes, no.
He's fascinated.
but that's the Olivier's quote, and it is true.
Yeah.
Yes, you open the play, and opening night, you're dynamic. You know, the great line in the theater is watch the second night. That's when it goes right in the toilet. You know, you're so high for the opening, the second night just goes, you know, and I did something with Henry Fonda one time, and one of Fonda's things was like he did Mr. Roberts for a year or more or something on Broadway, and you're going out there 8 times a week, you know. Basically, you don't do anything from noon on. You know, just your energy is all getting ready for that curtain to go up at 8 o'clock at night. You know, if you're going to do anything, you do it afterwards. All theater bars, you drink and you eat after the show. You don't go in there with a full stomach. But on the nights when Fonda, you know, didn't know anybody out in the audience, you know, because if somebody comes back after a show and you say, Tony, why didn't you tell me you were out there? You know, because you knew you would have done it different if you'd known Tony was out there. Fonda would go when he knew nobody in the, you know, he played for over a year, those plays. He would look through the peephole in the curtain. And he'd say, see that woman in the fifth row, 2 seats in, with the pink hat? He said, that's the one. And he'd do the performance for her, like it was his mother, so he wouldn't be gray, so he wouldn't be sloppy. And she never knew, but it prevented him from, you know, from slipping.
Wow.
He'd come off the stage. He said, come on, fellas, that was a damn 83. No, we were 87 last night. Come on, let's get it back up there. He would grade them. He wouldn't let. Wow. But that was the great stage actors.
What a pro. Know?
Well, yeah. Well, it. Now you ask someone to do a play, they won't do it more than 10 weeks or something. You know, it's they get bored. You know, the whole thing with before that was with theater. You couldn't get bored. You know, Life with Father. Ran for 5, 6, 7, 8 years all the way through the Second World War. You know, Harold Lindsay and his wife. But
these people put their time in. Well, we're talking about money. Let's talk about Blood Simple, because did you have the brothers pay you in cash when you took the gig?
They're trying to get the IRS on me.
I don't know nothing about nothing.
Hello to Mike, by the way, who Emmett is playing to.
When I was doing Silkwood with Meryl Streep,
right,
in Dallas, and I got a call. I got a call from my agent at the time, and I had heard that they had turned a couple things down that, you know, were being offered to me or something, and I never heard about it, and I got totally pissed. I said, I want to read everything. I want to see everything. You don't turn anything down without me seeing it. So I'm down there, and I get this script from these two brothers down in Austin, Texas, you know, the Joe and Ethan Cohen.
Yep.
And they came out of Minnesota. Joel was a theater major at NYU. Ethan was a Princeton graduate, philosophy or something. So I get this script, and it's Blood Simple, and it all takes place at night. You know, it's very hard to shoot at night. It's hard to get any depth. You know, that's tough to do, and I slink around with his suit, his Panama suit and his hat and the whole thing. And it was interesting. I said, look at, I can take this character and like a Sidney Greenstreet, and I can work it out. And then 20 years time, when I'm old enough, you know, I can do it in a real movie, you know?
You didn't have a lot of faith.
Yeah. I'd flush it out because nothing could come of this thing. And, I, told the agents, I said, go see what they got. And the agent came back and said, "They'll give you 1% of the profits." I said, "I have a degree in business administration from college. 1% of zero is zero. I mean, what the fuck are we talking about?" and the agent comes back the next day and said, "They'll give you 2% of the gross." I said, "You went from profits to gross in one day?" I said, "It's still going to be nothing. No one's ever going to see the fucking film. But I own part of the film. I get checks on it all the time."
I love that.
From Blood Simple. And so I went down. I met the Coen brothers down there, you know, in Austin. And they had this little film they'd made up and so forth. And I'm up there doing Silkwood with Meryl, you know, and I'd go down to Austin for a week or two. And they had it right down to the very nth degree. They had been working on it for 2 years. You know, they raised their $300,000 or $400,000, and they had the whole thing. And I went down and the first time I'm there, I think I was getting $500 a day in expense money. You know, so they gave me a check, and I don't know who you guys are. I don't want your check. So they came back and gave me five $100 bills. You know, so I put them in my pocket. Then week after week after week. And finally, I got a wad going out. And I know everybody's looking at my pocket. And I'm going to get mugged. I put them in the ice cube tray. You know, I didn't know what to do.
You're hiding
money. I had created my own monster. I was paranoid. But I did their thing. And Joe would they kind of looked through the camera together. Joe was the director. But Ethan, they're just talk together. And Joe would say, I want you to go over there. And I say, well, what if I look this way? And they said, no, we can't afford that. And then I'd say something, and then I'd say, what if I do? He said, Joe, one of the great lines where Joe said, just humor me, Emmett. Will you please just humor me? You know, and that became one of them. And at one point in there, when I was up working on Silkwood, he gave me a call and said, Can you do you smoke? I said, no, I'm not a smoker. He said, can you blow a smoke ring? And I said, I'm not a smoker. And he said, would you work? And we want you, Danny Hidea, you know, is a guy, you know, the whole thing in the bar, a bar owner. And he said, so I tried to, you know, and they wanted me to blow smoke rings. And I have the cigar, I'm trying to do it. And all I did was get sick. And I called back and I said, I can't, you know, that's not working. He said, don't worry, we got a machine, we got the whole thing solved. So I go down. And I'm talking to Danny, and Danny's there, and I want to piss him off, and I blow a smoke ring right across, right at his face, right going across him, you know, and you know, really pissing the character, really pissing Danny off, and they got this billows right beside my ear, and but the smoke rings keep breaking; they don't stay together long enough, and they're getting, you know, because it's important within the frame of what they wanted to do, and find a little costume, little makeup girl. They just hired her. She was her first job. And she said, give me that goddamn cigar. She said, I used to smoke the silkwood with my four brothers out behind a barn. And she took the cigar and pow, she blasted it. You know, one after the other. Boom, boom. I mean, beautiful, you know. And you gotta inhale the whole thing to get it right, you know. She blasted them out and they boom, boom, boom. We got the whole scene. And I'm saying, well, this is what low-budget movies are all about. And I went out about – I went about 2 hours later. We're in a roadhouse outside of Dallas. There's Austin, I guess. And there she is sitting on the steps just puking her guts out. She'd given her life to this fucking movie. You know?
I love that.
You know, but –
something to tell her grandkids.
And I ran into her within the last 5 or 10 – she's still in the business. She's a prop lady. And she stayed in all the way.
Now,
but I think, did I answer the question?
Yeah, and then some.
Oh, good for me.
Now, a question I wanted to ask you, being a stage actor, doing the same dialogue night after night, do you find yourself going into autopilot, and what do you do about that?
Well, I'd mentioned before about Henry Fonda.
Yeah.
You know, like if you know somebody's out in the audience, you really, you know, you don't want to do a bad one.
Yeah.
Every audience plays differently. Why does somebody go out and fish on the Gulf or on Lake Champlain or something? You know, there's something about fishing. It's not that you catch a bass and a bat. You know, they play you differently. Each audience plays you differently. They miss this laugh. Why is that? What do we do? Then you try to make sure you don't miss the next one. You can sense the audience. You're playing them. They're, you know, and that becomes the life of it. There's also the pride of the business. You don't want an audience to hate you. You know, you want an audience that loves you, and you've got to do the play. And if they're not responding in the right places, you try to find out why and get them back in the other places. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
You don't look that smart.
Well, he's not. Well, he's a stand-up, Emmett. You know, he does stand-up three or four nights a week. So you must have a similar experience. Where why didn't the audience laugh at the joke they laughed at last night?
Oh my God! Yeah.
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 Why is that audience different?
It's like sometimes a joke that kills in the first show, in the second show they're staring at you.
Mysterious.
Yeah. So your question had nothing to do with me. It had something to do with.
By the way, the scene, the picking up the hat little business in Blood Simple. I know you've been asked this. That was your invention. That was your little bit of business.
I'm not sure. At one time I might have said it was, but I'm not sure. It could. The Coen brothers are so fucking smart. I mean, no one does a first movie and have it like the Blood Simple. I mean, you know, there are hundreds of movies made by people that you never hear about. You know, never a word.
Absolutely.
And Visser, my character, had an image of himself. Obviously, the hat was part of it. But you know, he just went through the whole pounding of the wall, getting his hands, you know.
The knife in the hand,
and the whole thing, and pounding the wall to get the knife out and the whole thing. And during all that, my hat had fallen off. You know, whatever the white thing was, you know, that the Western hat that I had on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he gets his hand back. He turns around and, you know, he's totally wiped. You know, he turns around And he's looking towards the door where he thinks whoever is involved, you know, he's going to come get them. And he looks at it, then he looks down and goes out of frame, comes back up and puts a hat on.
It's a great moment.
Now, yeah, and with hindsight, I like to think I might have thought of that because it was part of the character, but the Coen brothers might have thought of it too. I'm not sure. You know,
It's a great performance.
Yeah, well, it's a good performance. You know, yeah. I won an award for it.
You deserved it.
It was the first Spirit Award, the Independent Spirit Award. You know, Meryl Streep got who am I talking about? Got it for Trip to Bountiful. She got the first female award, and I got the first.
Oh, out of Africa. Yeah.
No.
Is she in Trip to Bountiful? Doesn't matter.
No, I didn't say out of it. I said Trip to Bountiful. Who in hell was in that?
Geraldine Page.
Yeah, well, Geraldine got it for that performance, and I got it for Blood Simple. That were the first two acting awards for the Spirit Awards. You know, after that, now they got about 17 different categories. But also the producer was there. We had a little function when they gave out the first Spirit Awards, you know, at some little restaurant in
right.
Hollywood. And the producer was there, and he was going to go up and get the award for, you know, best film. And he panicked the last minute. He said, Emmett, you do it. You do it. So I went up, you know, and they're giving this award for the best independent feature film. And I said, Rocky 2 just opened on 1,900 screens around the country. At no time during the run of Blood Simple were there 10 prints.
Wow.
And that's what a low-budget film was.
Right.
Isn't that wild? Stick your finger up the wrong person's ass? you know, a friend of mine a while back broke his hand and put in a cast. Very next day, he falls, protects his bad hand, and he breaks his good one. So now he breaks that too, you know? So now he's got two busted flippers, you know? So I said to him, I said, Creighton, I hope your wife really loves you, because for the next 5 weeks, you can't even wipe your own goddamn ass. That's a test, ain't it? Test the true love.
I got a job for you.
Well, if pays right and it's legal, I'll do it.
It became its own life. And
sure,
so
but it's more than made its money back now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah, and then
it's
some.
It's made money for me. You know, and of course, the Coen brothers. Every time the Coen brothers do a new movie, they mention Blood Simple. So it's kept my career going.
And you showed up in the next one, too, in a wonderful little cameo.
Well, I talked them into that. They weren't interested. You know, and I remember I took them to the Players Club in New York I belonged to at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I took them to lunch down there. And I said, look, I'll do it, anything. And that was Raising Arizona.
Yeah, your moment is great.
And I said, I'll do anything. And they didn't, they said, okay, well, let them do this. So I went to Phoenix or something and did, every time Nicolas Cage gets out of jail, he's in the same
right.
shop.
It's great. Bill Parker.
Talk about finding this guy's head on the freeway.
It's fantastic.
Now, you worked with someone whose name has popped up on this show a bunch of times, Herschel Bernardi.
Oh, you were in Arnie. Do you have any memory of doing that show? He was a blacklisted actor.
Yeah, well, I've worked with other blacklisted actors,
yeah.
too. I'm trying to think who, it'll come to me. I knew him. We did the show. You know, he had the series and so forth.
You did a fair amount of TV in those days, too.
I was doing TV before I was doing movies.
Yeah, your Jimmy Stewart show. You did the Don Rickles show.
As my reputation for doing these, you know, these non sequential parts and little things became known, that it helped the thing along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my reputation grew, and they kept getting me to do other things to help along. But I did this show with them. I don't remember that. Who did Detective Story, got an Oscar for it?
Lee Grant.
Lee Grant.
Yeah,
Lee Grant was blacklisted.
Yeah, we had her on this show.
Yeah, Lee Grant was, you know, wonderful.
Yeah.
She's in her 90s now.
Yes, she lives a few blocks from here.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart.
She is.
We're doing a play in Stockbridge, Mass. Lee Grant was playing, it was a new play by, and they're doing a workshop of it. She played with Bill Devane and Lee Grant, and I come in. It's set in the country or something, you know, type of thing. And it was a workshop, and we were there for 2 weeks rehearsal or something. And there was a little nightclub in, I don't know, away from Stockbridge. I can't think of the name of the town. But you'd go down with the music. You'd go down these stairs to get into it, the whole thing. And we're, you know, getting smashed like we always did. And we're leaving there, and Lee Grant, Devane's going up, and Lee Grant's behind him, and I'm right behind Lee Grant. And I'm right there, and there's her rear facing right at me, and the tight little ass, and the whole thing. I kind of reached up and squeezed it. And as I squeezed it, I said, uh-oh, I'm in big trouble. And she stopped. And she looked down at me, and she said, thank you.
Great story.
Oh, I know. It's
we have to ask Lee about that.
But
I just saw her a couple of weeks ago. I mean, I just had the pleasure of having dinner with her a couple of weeks ago. She's great.
Yeah, tell her, yeah, because I watched you do a session at the Actors Studio 4 or 5 years ago. But
I'll say hi for you.
I think she's 93 years old.
She is.
Now,
you were in Airport 77 with her, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. And she said things to me there, too. She said, don't do this or don't do that. You know, she'd give me advice to a young actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been friends for a long time.
She's lovely.
Yeah, she's sweet.
Of those people that you played the tennis match with on screen, the Pacinos and the Redfords and the Beatties and the Paul Newmans, was there somebody that you particularly enjoyed going back and forth with more than others? You worked with Hoffman more than a couple of times.
Yeah, I don't
Paul
really
Paul Newman
do.
And Slapshot?
I think I did another movie with Paul.
Maybe Twilight?
Yeah, Twilight Zone or something. Not Twilight.
Twilight.
Or something. Was it Twilight?
Yeah.
And Paul, you know, I was there, and I'm working with these big people, you know, and I'm just Emma Walsh, you know, and I was there, and they knew I was helping, and I appreciated helping,
mm-hmm.
and none of them ever came at me. I mean, anybody that did, there were only two or three that ever tried, you know, and
What does that mean? They tried to best you in the scene? They tried to...
They tried. They thought they could take it, you know. And
I see.
They're in the unmarked part of the cemetery now, you know. in answer to your question, no, they were all just wonderful, and I was there to help, and it was a tennis match. You know, we hit the ball, you know, back and forth in the audience, and it worked, you know, and that's why I was brought in. They were good people. Who did I mention to you about... The guy that changed all the dialogue, the television actor, what was his name? I can't think of it.
The star of Beretta.
Huh?
The
star
of Robert Blake.
Robert Blake. Robert Blake. He did Beretta.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was brought in to do a Beretta type of thing at one time, and there was a lot of dialogue. Learning dialogue has nothing to do with acting. It's a mechanical stunt. You get it out of the way. Then the acting happens.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm ever around actors who haven't learned it, they don't even know the first step of acting, you know, type of thing. So I had a whole bunch of dialogue. I get it all done. I come in to do this Beretta with Robert Blake. And he comes in and to my dressing room where I went to his. And we read the scene over. He said, yeah. You know, and because I'm ready to hammer it, you know, I'm going to kill it. And a few minutes later, his assistant comes to me and says, here, give me a script. Bobby wants to change this and this and this and this. And this. You know, he'd take a sentence out of a paragraph, you know, or suddenly, Bobby Blake didn't learn it. He was just trying to get through the job, but he wasn't going to let some actor come in and make him look bad. He was going to make sure they looked bad also.
Wow. Wow.
You get me on that one?
Yeah.
And I learned that one. You can't win. They'll switch it around.
That's fascinating.
I know it. I'm fascinated.
Emmett, I got a couple of questions from listeners, if you'll indulge me.
We will return to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast after this.
These are a couple of questions from guests. There's a guy named Robert Martin, a listener, wants to know, do you have any memories of filming a movie with Jason Robards called Raise the Titanic?
Yeah, I did. I knew Jason for a long time. I knew him in New York.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, he was doing Little Big Man, I think it was, or something. I don't know, maybe it was. He was doing a Broadway play, and they taught us in New York, you know, hang out where the actors hang out, go where the actors go. So, like, I was in the Broadway softball league. I was in the Broadway bowling league.
Oh.
They get used to seeing you.
You really are a jock.
I am a jock. Mm-hmm. I'm a par golfer. Then you'd go to the bar afterwards, after the show, and you'd drink with him. And I knew Jason for a long time. And I do a lot of barroom poetry, the Robert Service and Casey and the whole thing. I learned it all as a kid. Jason and I are drinking one time, and he said, hey, I got the kid's last fight on a cassette. That was a famous poem about two guys that grew up together, went a different way, then they suddenly end up fighting together, and neither one wants to hurt the other guy, but they, you know, the whole thing, it was called The Kid's Last Fight. It's a great, great little poem. So Jason and I go up to his apartment in the Dakota, you know, around 76.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And he was married to Lauren Bacall then, you know. And we go in there, and we're drunk as fiddlers, bitches. And he's over there trying to put the needle.
Drunk as fiddlers.
Trying to put the needle on the... Lauren Bacall comes out with a broom, and she starts beating the shit out of me. You drunken bum! Yeah, you know. So I went back a long time with Jason.
I love that.
But we did. What was the film?
The Titanic.
Raise the Titanic.
Yeah.
Well, Jason and I are flying over to Greece. You know, from L.A., I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in first class, of course. We're flying all night or something. And Jason's sitting with me, I guess, in a seat. And I think his wife is with the two kids in the seat in front of us or something. And Jason said, you know what I'm proud of? I said, no. He said, see those two kids? I said, yeah. He said, they never saw me drunk. They never saw me drunk.
Wow.
And that's what Jason was proud of.
Wow.
And he didn't drink anymore. Once he stopped. But he crashed himself up on the freeway, wrapped his face all up.
Yeah.
Took him over a year and a half before we went back to work. But he was very proud of that.
Wow.
But Jason was a good guy.
That's quite a story.
But I knew him on both sides. You know, I knew him on the drunk side and the side. You know, what the hell?
I heard you say that Clean and Sober was material that you were attracted to because you came from, you knew drinking.
Well, I'm an old drunk, you know. I was a periodic. My father was an alcoholic. He was a U.S. Customs officer on the border. I grew up with AA, you know, around it. You know, my father, it never clicked with my father until he'd finally buried everybody. Then there was nothing to do but go talk about it. And and it became one of the legendary speakers in AA back in Vermont there.
Oh.
But that's basically what happens with alcoholics, you know, eventually can't take it. But the whole family was the Irish on both sides. You know, they're performers, you know, that type of thing. And I came out of that. And your question initially started this with what?
Oh, I was just saying how, and it's a great performance in Clean and Sober, how you were attracted to the material.
Because I was a drunk.
Yeah.
The surprise of the whole thing on Clean and Sober, it opens with a monologue of the just camera on me doing the whole thing. And my background, I was never AA, but I was a drunk. And my father was AA. My whole idea was not to make them look bad, type of thing. And then when I saw the movie, I realized it made me look like an asshole as opposed to someone that really believed in what he was up to with the AA thing.
Interesting.
As I recall, there's some in there. But I'm very much, if you don't know how to drink, what the hell?
In Clean and Sober, there's a scene where you're in a diner and you have a bowl of chocolate ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
A chocolate cake and a chocolate ice cream shake.
Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you what that's all about. With my background in AA, Alcoholic Anonymous, what they try to do is substitute one addiction for the other addiction. See, so if you were a drunk, you'd try to get him into macrame, or say you'd try to get him spending his time, And I was a drunk talking to Michael Keaton, I got him over there. We're in the diner, and I said, "Tell me your story." And Michael's going on and on, and he's filling in with his own lies and everything. And I was the alcoholic interviewing him, doing the whole thing, and. I had substituted food or sugar or ice cream or something for my addiction.
Right.
And that's what they do. And I just kept it going. I remember the whole cast and the whole crew went crazy because we shot for a day and I did nothing but eat ice cream. Got obviously in time incredibly sick. But I wanted to show that that's what the alcoholic person was, that he, you understand me on this a little bit?
Oh, yeah.
What am I doing?
Yeah, yeah.
What am I doing?
Yes. Yeah.
You don't like it? He said, none of this has been recorded. he just changed the mind. So basically what I was trying to do is, while I'm listening to Michael, and he's going through all the lies that alcoholics would, boom, 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 boom. Then he says the one thing that I jump on. Which was, the girl had died in his bed, the whole thing, what it was.
Right.
But I wanted the reformed alcoholic to show. And of course, I've had alcoholics come to me and say that really, really nailed it. That's what it was all about, type of thing, that it wasn't an actor. It was, that's what an AA
sure,
does.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is there a moment, Emmett, when you're rapping for the day? Is there a moment where you say, I know I nailed that, that it felt right, or is there always a degree of uncertainty until you see the finished product?
I can look at my work and from 30, 40 years ago and say, yeah, he did that pretty good, type of thing. I didn't phone it in. I didn't phone it in. I worked hard on everything I did, type of thing. But I have people who are not my biggest fans. There are people at company that are not, they didn't like that or they didn't like this.
Really?
Like that. Yeah. Yeah. The ones that I let live,
Did you have a disagreement with Ridley Scott when you were making Blade Runner, something about him making you smoke? You threatened to hang him by his balls. Do I have this right?
you guys can take good stories and really ruin.
Okay, I fucked that one up.
Yeah, yeah. Really? We on Blade Runner. Harrison and
Ridley.
We're in a room and I'm showing film.
Right.
Of the Blade Runners that are, they've gotten out or something, and Harrison is there.
The replicants.
The replicants. And showing film of the replicants. And Ridley says at some point, would I smoke? You know, so I start smoking, and we go on, and we're shooting and shooting and shooting, and getting incredibly sick. And it's Ridley shoots a lot. He shot a lot of film. And I'm getting sicker and sicker. And Alan Ladd Jr. was one of the producers on it. And I wasn't aware of it, you know. And there are people come in behind the camera and watch for a while. They go, you know,
sure.
No one watches a movie very long being shot if they're a civilian. And it's so boring, you know. The and Alan Ladd came in and the whole thing. And at some point, Ridley did something. And I said, shit, you know, I got sick or something. I said, you ought to be fucking hung from the ceiling by the balls and twitches slowly from left to right. You know, and Ridley says, I feel that way a lot anyway. And Alan Ladd Jr. Had me pulled off my next movie.
Wow.
He whatever it was I'd been hired for. Something with Michael Keaton's first movie or something, one of his early films. And he had me pulled off it. And then Ridley, we had to change dialogue, how many replicants there were. We kept changing and changing and changing. I'd come back in 3 months and come back. And, you know, and at one point, one of the producers on...
Bud Yorkin.
Bud Yorkin. Bud Yorkin is in there. And I'm redoing a couple lines, you know, not on camera, redoing the lines. And we'd do it, the number of replicants and that kind of shit. And I said, Bud, I'm going to be back. And Bud says, you're not coming back. That's it. I said, no, there's going to be a change other than now. And this is about, you know, we're an hour and a half, you know, a year and a half into the movie. You know, not even get close. It's Ridley's, you know. And I said, and we ended up betting $10, you know. And a couple of months later, I get a call from Ridley Scott saying, what the fuck did you say to Bud Yorkin? He said, I need you in the fucking film, and he won't let me have you. He said, what the fuck's going on? It was a $10. It was a $10. So I came in and did it, and there was an envelope with a $10 bill in it. But that was the number of replicants in the whole thing, you know. But Ridley, good guy.
Make some great films.
Yeah, you know, he lost his brother. That's all sad.
Yes, that's tragic. You know, one more question I have for you just from a listener. I know you're shocked that we have anybody listening to the show, Emmett, but Ray Gustini has a question about The Jerk. He says the phrase "die milk face" has long been a part of his daily parlance. Those things that you're yelling at Steve Martin's character when you're the crazy sniper and the jerk, what was scripted and what was improvised? By you, how much of that stuff?
We're shooting in a shooting gallery underneath the house.
Right,
that's where I'm practicing. That's right. That's where all that dialogue is.
Right,
you know, type of thing.
Carl Reiner. Carl Reiner.
Yeah, who wrote it? Carl
I
wrote
think it.
It
was Carl and Carl Gottlieb.
Yeah. They great freedom with Carl. You think of how to do it, then you think of how to maybe do it, that type of thing all around, and how the dialogue came up or something. You know, if he gave it to me, or else I kept, you know, like, you know, the stupid profanities and all.
Die milk face.
I wouldn't, you know, I won't take it away from Carl. I might be saying all his dialogue. I might have added a couple of mine.
Yeah,
you know.
Dead center, say your prayers, half-breed.
Hey, Harry, look at this. What's the matter with these cans?
Die, milkface!
These cans are defective. They're springing leaks. Come over here and look at this.
Listen, you better run for cover. You're going to spring a leak.
Huh?
We don't have defective cans. We have a defective pipeline out there.
He hates these cans. Stay away from the cans.
Die, gas pumper.
I got to get away from those cans.
You're very funny. I mean, I want to say, too, that at some point you talk about having a gift But you know, in scenes like in movies like Fletch and The Jerk, you seem to have, and Raising Arizona certainly, you seem to have a natural way with comedy.
Well, I'm not a comedic actor. You know, I'm an actor. I'm an Irishman, so they're you know, God damn, if they look in the mirror and you're an Irishman, you gotta laugh. I had the gift, and I got lucky. But there are a lot of people that never get lucky, you know. And but I've had a grand time, and
it's a great body of work, Emmett.
There, you know, like who's the guy now doing the one about the costumer, the movie that's out now, the up for an Academy Award. You know who I'm talking. You know what I'm talking about.
Which costumer?
Oh, he's a dresser. Come on. But he said it's his last movie. He'll never do another movie.
Oh, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, he's burned out.
Yeah. Well,
he's done some great work.
He's quit several times.
He's playing a lot of different people. But, you know, I don't know how old he is. He's probably 60, 65. But he's had it. I've never had it. You know, it's always fun. You know, it's always, let me go out and see what I can get away with.
I love that.
But then again, he's playing major roles. I'm just playing walking in for 2 or 3 days.
This is a quote from you. You said, "When I get to 100 movies, I guess I die." but now 108 and counting. You're still here.
It's 118.
118, and you're still working.
Still working.
And I look at your IMDb page today, and I see you've got 4 or 5 films in production and things in pre-production.
Oh, I don't think they're in production. What's the one that's coming out that I got to? It's opening a film festival.
Yeah, give us a plug.
A Change in the Air.
Okay.
Olympia Dukakis plays my wife. I don't know if she says who plays her husband, but I'm using her.
I saw that indie you were in with Christopher Plummer from a couple of years ago too. It was excellent.
Well, that was an interesting.
Very good. Man in the Chair.
What was it?
Man in the Chair. You were the retired screenwriter in the nursing home.
I did a scene with the guy that Natalie Wood.
Oh, Robert Wagner's in it. Yeah,
they're picking on him.
Yeah. It's a good film.
Yeah. No, the man in the chair was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, type of thing.
Very good.
Chris was interesting. A nice man.
To work with Christopher Plummer.
But he grew up in Montreal. That's only 60 miles from me.
That's right. He's a Canadian.
Yes, he is. Okay, you guys had it?
You got anything else for this man before we let him go and get on with his life?
How much editing do you have to do this? I mean, we've been here for 7 hours.
A little bit. We're about done. I just wanted to say I heard you.
Do you cut it down someplace?
Yeah, we'll cut it down. We'll trim it down a little bit. Not much, because people want to hear from you, Emmett.
Can you send me a cassette of this?
We're going to send you the link, and I'm going to send – and I also want to say that Emmett is the only guest that ever sent gifts before he was a guest on the show. He sent me a trading card from Wild Wild West. He sent me a $2 bill. Not sure what he was trying to tell me with that one. You want to ask this man anything else?
No, I guess I'll – okay, I'll –
He's going to rep.
If you let me know where you're performing when I'm in New York – I won't go into that area.
Have you ever seen his act?
No, I don't want to.
I dare say I think you'd enjoy it.
All right.
I have a quote here from you, Emmett. You said, for a guy from a small town, you didn't do badly.
I was senior class president in high school. Ten girls and 3 boys. I come from the big time.
You did pretty well. And thanks for doing this. I know it was a schlep, and thanks to Mike Gargano for making it happen.
Well, thank Mike, because he just became my enemy.
So Gilbert's going to wrap up.
Well, I'm Gilbert Gottfried, and this has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre, and we have been talking to one of the kings of the great character actors, M. Emmett Walsh.
Emmett, keep going. Never retire.
All right. Fun and dandy.
Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast is produced by Dara Gottfried and Frank Santapadre, with audio production by Frank Verderosa. Web and social media is handled by Mike McPadden, Greg Pear, and John Bradley Seals. Special audio contributions by John Beach. Special thanks to Paul Rayburn, John Murray, John Fotiatis, and Nutmeg Creative. Especially Sam Giovanco and Daniel Farrell for their assistance.